decided to go slow. I tell you what, you do get throttling over time. I mean, it's like any supplier, right? I mean, definitely I bought the highest package on BT, but there's no way am I getting whatever it is that they're giving me. They're kind of over time, as your longevity's there, they just neglect you because you're locked in, basically, because I'm not going to switch now and they know it. So I wonder whether that's an interesting like philosophy to adapt to when you're doing things like community management, right? Like, do you inevitably neglect the most loyal people because you can rely on them? And it's the same way with voting, you know, how political parties often neglect the base, so to speak, because, you know what, who are they going to vote for? They're obviously going to vote for us. So, you know, we need to pay more attention to the marginals rather than the people at the baseline. I think customers are the same, users are the same, you know, we neglect the most loyal.
Well, yeah, absolutely. We prioritize. People come around for dinner. You prioritize your guests having a good experience over your, like, the people you live with.
Yeah, that's pretty poor when you think about it. Because, I mean, dinner is slightly different in a sense. Obviously, you know, you're there to do something special for them because they haven't made the effort to come over. But that we need to solve the problem about loyalty of the people that have really been with you for that period of time. Why are we giving them less attention than the new people that we're so desperate to attract? So I think, by the way, I was just complaining about internet speeds, folks, but I think it's kind of relevant, isn't it? Like, if you have a very established and loyal customer, are you like just slightly moderating down your effort because you know that person's never going to go away? You basically become complacent and you're slowly neglecting that relationship. We have to find a way to correct that. I'd be interested to know whether there's any software to help with it, you know, to say, you know what, that's a customer. Longevity means you've got to put this amount of effort in or this amount of discount over time. If you can't put the effort in, maybe the cost slides down in compensation for the effort, right? Rather than, you know, locking people in and just, you know, trusting that the switching cost is too high for them to go anywhere else. Anyway, I didn't mean to start this show with a complaint, but there we are. We have done that, and we are bringing it to you. It's Brain Food Live on Air, episode 154, every Friday, folks. 154 episodes we've done so far. That's at least 3 years of programming. Has there been a longer running live stream on Brain Food Live? I don't think so. So thank you everyone for tuning in to us today. Quick sound check, like everyone else, like we do every week. Folks on Crowdcast, if you can hear me on Crowdcast, please let me know in a chat stream whether the audio is okay. Can you actually see Adam, by the way? He's complaining that his video is not working. So if you can see us both there and the audio is fine, please let us know. We are live streaming also on LinkedIn Live. This is my LinkedIn Live. So if you're following me somewhere on LinkedIn, you should be able to see this. And if you do, give me a thumbs up. Let me know whether you can hear me okay. We are also basically tapping it everywhere. LinkedIn Live, Facebook Live, Twitter Live. That's all going out simultaneously on one broadcast. I think that's the maximum you can do, actually, on the plan that I have. So hopefully everyone's getting blasted with this show today. All right, I think a few people can hear us and see us. That's okay. Quick one to our sponsors. Remember, folks, none of this happens without our sponsors. So please spend a bit of time in checking them out. I'm selecting some of the best businesses, most innovative companies, companies that really care about the community also. This week's sponsor is Tripad, tripad.com. They are an ATS focusing on the UK market generally, and I think doing extremely well in things like public sector and that type of marketplace. Do check them out. They're a great company, tribad.com. They've also, and I think they're still running, quite an important report, which I want you to be aware of, which is called Stop the Bias Report. And this is quite an interesting a bit of research that they've done on the candidate side to figure out from the candidates how they feel that they're being treated by recruitment, their recruitment experience. Like, do they feel as if they're getting an Aegis experience? Do they feel as if their agenda is an impactful to their success or lack thereof in the process? I think it's worth availing yourself, kind of know what the report might kind of produce in terms of results, but do take a read of it. I think it's important that we elevate that and keep at the top of our minds. So do check that out. Okay, I think let's get on with the show. Adam, good to see you, man. How has your week been? You've been okay?
Yeah, it's been very good. I changed my working hours a little bit. I kind of start, right. I kind of start mid morning and finish like in the evening now, and I get up and go to the gym first thing. And the reason for that simply is because I'm kind of spending a lot more time with people in America than I was before, since I've now got American bosses and stakeholders.
So basically, yeah. So you start 12 and 9 or something like that?
No, it's not quite that. I probably about 10, 11 and like 8, roughly.
Yeah. It's interesting to know that shift. I mean, it's a lot of people have... I remember a friend of mine used to work shifts all the time and he loved it because he was always having an additional spare time during the day rather than the night. And it actually suited him because he was at the stage in his life where actually... he wasn't doing much night stuff anyway, right? So it was like he actually preferred being able to do stuff during the day. So I think that worked out really well for him. So, yeah, hopefully it works out well for you, man. And especially fitness, it should make a difference fitness-wise if you've got that extra morning to do something.
Yeah, the only thing is, one thing I have found is I end up going to bed later because I take a little bit longer to switch off, you know, in the evening. So I'm maybe not getting, but I still got to get the kids to school in the morning. So I'm probably getting less sleep as a result. Anyway, pros and cons.
That's it. You got to watch that as well. If you're not getting the deep sleep, you got to find maybe a midday nap or something would work.
Yeah, good idea.
Sleep's a science. We need to get better at it. We assume we know what we're doing, and absolutely, we're getting worse. We don't know what we're doing. We need to relearn how to properly. Kind of listen to the circadian rhythm a little bit. Anyway, listen, did you read the newsletter last week? If so, what was interesting about it, Adam?
So the article, the first one I want to talk about is the one that was really surprising. It was another BBC work-life study, and it showed that it was taking information from America, and it showed that when mums out earn their husbands, they actually end up doing more housework. And I find this really strange because you would expect that naturally it would change. It would all kind of shift a bit, but it doesn't. It actually means that they end up doing more housework at home.
It's fascinating. Really fascinating post, isn't it? There was a study on it as well as the BBC post. But folks, I'd be interested to know for married couples watching this, if you had that experience where the mother has ended up out earning the father. So basically, there's a transition as to who started to earn more. According to this research, the mother ends up doing more housework when she earns more, in order to basically compensate for a feeling that she may be overemphasizing work rather than responsibilities for family. So really interesting psychology. Guilt housework, CJ, that's kind of like, I think a very accurate way of describing it is guilt housework, but the overall obviously amount of effort spent is gonna be increased for the mother compared to the father. And I think that may lead to all kinds of, you know, other reports we see in terms of additional stress levels, you know, mental health problems happening for women at a much higher rate at a certain age. So it's a fascinating report. Really hard to, as you say, Adam, counterintuitive, but I think worth diving a bit deeper into. Not true for everyone, of course, but it kind of is something that it's explicable. And the study is explicable with a theory that I think, you know, kind of meshes a little bit with, you know, how we might think relationships work.
I want to link that to something that a question that was posed to me in a roundtable a couple of days ago, which was the whole, and it's to do with another element of brain food as well. So the concept of allowing people to work from anywhere, there appears to be some evidence emerging that a higher proportion of men will choose to work in the office and a higher proportion of women will choose to work from home. Now,
that's interesting.
This is, yeah, and this is from this roundtable I was on. There was a few people who confirmed this based on like the data they're getting from security pass, you know, entry into the office.
Even more interesting. Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you're, I think we're all probably appreciate that if people are in the office, naturally, they are going to get more opportunity. They're going to get, build more relationships. They're going to probably more likely to get promoted. Is this whole concept going to further exacerbate the gulf between the number of female managers and business leaders versus males? Is it artificially going to set us back on the diversity agenda even further?
I leave it open to the audience to think about that. So please do comment on whether you think that's the case. So premise is there is a disparity between on-premise, basically proximity bias. People on-premise are likely to get promoted faster, so career track goes up. And there is a gender component, a gender variance to how people prefer on-premise versus remote. So even though maybe a slight variance, it's still there. And if that's the second, if that's the second premise is true, does that then lead to exacerbating a gender disparity at leadership level and obviously income levels and stuff like that? Very, very interesting. Love to know your thoughts on it.
I asked my wife that question, and her immediate response back was, "You don't let it. Simple as that. Only if you let it do that will that happen." And I said, "Well, that's an idealistic response, and of course." Humans are riddled with subconscious bias, and it's going to be very, very difficult to completely get rid of that. And Julia's point is one of the reasons why, well, Julia says the main reason why hybrid setups are tricky. I do agree with this, and it's an interesting and emerging concept because it's not the sort of thing that we had during the pandemic because nobody could work in an office. So we're still learning new things and facing new scenarios because of that damn pandemic, you know, all the time. And some of them, life's going to be better than it was in a lot of ways before the pandemic, but there's a danger that it could be worse as well.
Yeah, I think without question, there's going to be, it's something we're wrestling with. It's good that we're having a conversation at this point and discussing it. I'd be interested to know whether there is a remedy. I'm not sure there is. Other than maybe completely decoupling a human decision making on promotions, you know, you can literally do it on output, and just the machine will tell you.
Yeah, that's the wrong thing, though, isn't it? That'll just promote the high performers.
Well, what's wrong with that?
We all know in recruitment agencies that's the wrong thing, don't we?
All right, yeah, but I'm totally in. If we're truly committed to performance related pay, then the human being should not be deciding the pay rates for your employees or the promotion or the speed of career development. It should just simply be a software. So I think I'm all for that. I think maybe a potential solution. The other thing would be just to switch immediately to one mode of working rather than hybrid, because then everyone is on the same, which I think a lot of businesses will do, even though I think even more businesses are going to continue wrestling with hybrid and then trying to make sure mitigate some of these issues. And I think you could see it either way. I mean, legitimately, there could be someone who's on-premise who deserves to be promoted, doesn't get promoted because you've tried to mitigate against a potential bias you think is there, and then someone remote gets promoted in order to balance this out, and the on-premise person might think, what do I need to do here? You know, so I think it's almost like you're just storing up a problem that is very difficult to identify how to fix it. Anyway, that's another Brain Food Live. We should talk about that one. It's a good one to discuss. But yeah, loads of remote sort of working stuff going into Brain Food at this point, because I think we are starting to get enough research and data to start having some interesting conversations about it. Okay, give us another one, Adam.
This is not going to need a lot of discussion, but it was really heartwarming. The story about Walter Ortam, the Brazilian 100-year-old worker who's been at the same organization for over 84 years. I mean, that's retention, isn't it? That's going to bring up your stats. I hope he's enjoyed his 84 years in that company is actually the main thing that I've got to say here. And he didn't feel like he was trapped and he had no other options. Like, you know, 74 years ago, he felt like he was institutionalized already and life on the outside would never have been any good. But 84 years in one company is incredible and good on him. Most people don't live that long.
I know. And he's just literally soldiered on. I was in two minds to say whether this is a good or bad thing, because is he a truly great employee that everyone loves and you have to keep him? Or is there some sort of does he have some dirt on the CEO or something? And you can't get rid of him.
I wonder how many people's careers have been blocked by Walter sitting in the same job the whole for 100%. How long do I have to wait here before I get promoted? Damn, Walter.
And not only this, but he's going to know more about the business than anybody in the pot that can possibly know about the business. Yeah, he literally is the institution. Again, folks, very interesting one to talk about. Like, what is the optimal time of service with a single employer? Obviously, no one's going to beat Walter in this day and age, but what is it? Back when I was working for a company, it's now 10 years ago, I would have thought 3 years, 4 years optimum is the optimum amount of time you should spend with any single employer without some sort of dramatic change. But now, is it less? Is it more? I mean, you tell me. I think it's probably about 18 months, 2 years now. It's crazy. Okay.
I bet he knows where all the bodies are buried and he put a lot of them in the ground himself.
Well, no doubt. These are all metaphorical, by the way. But yes, I think someone with that amount of time in the business, I don't know how you would even CEO that type of person, right? It's like, are you a performance manager guy who's been there 84 years? No. How are you going to even do this?
I also really hope that he's kept up to date with all the times and he's got like some sort of centralized work system and he's got all his apps and all that, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, so... Jonathan Kidder's article about how to prep for an interview at, I mean, you don't see this very often, how to prep for an interview at Amazon, Google, Meta, Microsoft. If you're looking for, I mean, there's so many people I know have gone to these companies in the last year and got jobs with these businesses, especially Meta in the last few months. They've been hiring like a whole stellar cast, and Microsoft have as well. Yep. So you know, if you want to go and get one of these big beasts on your CV, then read that article, and get yourself a job there.
Yep. You know what? You kind of should. I remember speaking to a friend of mine who was debating whether he should join Facebook or not, and I was saying, yeah. Like relocate and join. It's like literally no doubt about it, because that is such a door opener for you. You'll be working on cool projects, interesting stuff. You'll be interacting with interesting people. Plus, even though we hate the idea of credentialism in recruiting, the bottom line is that's going to be a massive door opener for you going forward if you have it on your CV. I didn't actually know this when I was a younger person and looking at jobs. I didn't consider the brand value of the companies that ended up employing me, but it's actually one of the most significant things that is out there, which is completely unfair. I know all of this. I'm a big critic of credentialism in any case, but it is an inevitable bias that we have. And if you have a Meta or a Google or an Amazon on your CV, you're going to get at least to the interview stage. You're going to make it through some of the basic stuff, and then it's up to you to then try and convert those barriers. But you're going to skip basically a number of stages if you do have that. So it makes sense to join some of these companies if you ever get the opportunity. So yeah, unfair world, but don't make the rules. Play the game. Let's talk about the topic, man. So strategic workforce planning. You said something really interesting to me a couple of weeks ago. I don't know whether you remember about your own education on strategic workforce planning. Can you just give us a little bit of a view on that? Because I think I can say with confidence that this is an area that you don't know too much about. And definitely I don't either. So what did you learn from your friend?
Yeah, so somebody that used to work with me introduced me to a strategic workforce planning expert. And just for an interest, because she thought it would be an interesting conversation. And this person had worked with my colleague on the Commonwealth Games, Glasgow 2014. And I thought I knew what strategic workforce planning was. And then when she said, it's nothing to do with forecasting how many of what type you're going to need. Strategic workforce planning is about, it was a lot more talent intelligence than than I had understood. So she was saying huge difference between workforce planning and strategic workforce planning, completely different thing. And she had nothing to do with workforce planning. So, you know, I'm not sure if people in the chat here have seen this distinction before as well. But I'm really interested to find out what our guests tell us about it. And you're right, I'm not going to claim I'm an expert on this subject because I'm not. But yeah, I look forward to talking about it.
I do as well, because this is an education for me. So let's, without further ado, let's bring on our guests, because they've been sitting there very patiently. Let's see whether Perry is here. I think he is. There he is, Perry Timms. I think this may be Perry's debut, actually. So let's get him on. We have CJ Green. There she is. Let's bring CJ on. And we also have Danny Hodgson, who is basically workforce planning evangelist, right? You know, if there's one person that bangs on about workforce planning more than anybody, it's a Danny Hodgson. But no, here's Perry Timms. Perry, welcome to the show, man. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be back. And nice to get that warm-up chat ready already. So, yeah.
Great stuff. Perry, for the few people that don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you? What it is you do?
Sure, yeah. I'm the founder and chief energy officer of People and Transformational HR. There's 18 of us. We mainly operate in OD. We're a certified B Corporation, four-day operating week, fully remote. And yeah, we're really interested in this topic.
Fantastic stuff. Perry, great to have you on the show. We have CJ there as well. CJ, great to see you. Good to meet you.
Hello.
For the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you and what it is you do, CJ?
Yeah, I'm co-founder of an organization called Brave Goose. So we are a HR software platform, very different to most HR platforms in the marketplace. We're not about storing HR data. We're about how do you do HR stuff, the people stuff really well in organizations. And that's what our platform does.
Great stuff. And we have Danny Hodgson here as well. Danny, great to see you, sir. For the people who don't know you, can you introduce yourself? What it is you do?
Yeah, good afternoon. So Danny Hodgson, former disgruntled TA director turned co-founder of Foresight, which is, depending on your definition of workforce planning software.
That is amazing. Okay, so Danny, I'm going to go straight with you because you're the person that basically kind of introduced, or should I say, just crashed in sort of the barriers for me with regards to workforce planning. You're saying fundamentally... you told me that what something that stuck in my mind, which was, you know what, so much of recruitment, the recruitment challenges that we face are based on a lack of planning, which is why we don't have the time where we all get the sense that it's all firefighting all the time. Emergency recruitment is actually default. Like, this is how we recruit, is always emergency, which is why we have these problems. And actually, if we had 6 months more runway or 3 months more runway, we'd actually be able to do all of those things a lot better, assess better, better candidate experience, better stakeholder relationships, boom, 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 everything better with better planning. So, Danny, why don't we do it then? It's obvious we should do it, so why not? Why doesn't it happen?
Why doesn't it happen? Well, I think Perry might have mentioned or touched on it in the chat. So whose responsibility is it? So is it TAs? Is it HR? Is it the business? More often than not, it's somewhere in the middle. And because it's somewhere in the middle, nobody really puts their arms around it. And because nobody puts their arms around it, the only people feeling the pain are people in TA and HR, depending on what workforce planning data you want to extract. Like you said, every pain point that I used to feel as a TA director, if you do all of the root cause analysis, every hiring manager escalation, right, every unsatisfactory candidate experience, every long time to hire, every high cost buy, root cause analysis stems back to the line managers not owning or downloading their demand planning or workforce planning data to the right function to support them. Every point, root cause analysis comes back to workforce planning.
So you've said that no one owns it, but isn't it actually the case that the line managers own it? I mean, if I'm a line manager, don't I have the budget? Is it my responsibility to plan my department and then say, right, I need these people? So...
It is, yeah, you're right. So line management should own it, but they don't, because they're employed to do a specific job. They're a technical expert in whatever, right? 9 hours a day, that's what they concentrate. They're not a workforce planning expert. They will never think to wake up one day and go, "Hung, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to contact recruitment and HR and say, this is what my function needs and this is what my function should look like in 1, 3, 5 years' time." and they will never do it because, like, we're too busy dealing with all of this stuff in the reactive world, they're also very busy. So they're not trained in workforce planning. So that's why we need to own it, but we need to coach them into explaining why it's important for them to own it.
Right, very, very interesting. Perry, CJ, you've been nodding heads there on Danny's sort of exposition. Do you agree with the analysis that basically it's fundamentally an ownership problem? It's one of those essential tasks that is just diffused across too many sort of areas and no one's actually owning it. And essentially what happens is the recruiting team or whoever is handling sort of the to solve the workforce issue, it basically just has to ingest all the pressure. Is that a sort of an experience that you can kind of validate through your experience in coaching and indeed working internally with these businesses?
Perry, shall I go first and then you can pitch in?
Totally, so completely.
Is it an ownership challenge? I think it comes with all of the people stuff that's a bit gnarly and a bit kind of challenging to deal with. It comes from a busy stuff challenge. It comes from not quite being sure what strategic workforce planning is. And that sounds pretty daunting. So actually, there must be an expert somewhere that knows how to do this stuff because I don't. And I think it's exactly as all has already been talked about. You know, people have busy existences and the moment that they need to do something is at a moment of panic rather than at the moment of, you know, what's the strategy coming up in the future and where is my talent sitting now and where do I need to get it to and how do we take baby steps to get it there? We think about this in the moment of panic and everyone does, you know, HR included, and that's why we get to where we get to with this stuff, I think.
So I've been on both sides of the fence, both as a line manager with the responsibility to deliver a function and then as an advisor to help line managers do it. And in both of my early career kind of ventures, that wording and that kind of philosophy came nowhere near me. It was a zero sum budget thing. That's all it was. It's like, there's your budget for people. Just do what you do with that. And it was so crude and ineffective. Now I know it's about organizational capabilities. It sits above a level of skill and is, what does this organization need now and next at a capability level, which is an aggregation of skills? And who have we got who fits that and who haven't we got and we need to get in? And I'm seeing in the work I'm doing with clients, which is why I got so vexed about it, I wanted to kind of really raise the bar on it, HR business partner being pushed into conversations with directors, and they're trying to get something going on strategic workforce planning. And directors keep saying, just plug my gaps, just plug my gaps, just plug my gaps. And they're going to TA, and TA is saying, what gaps? This job description, far too crude. Absolutely no future trajectory at all. It's the most underwhelming thing I've seen in a long time. And it is causing massive problems now. And I think it's been amplified during all the kind of COVID shifting.
So it strikes me the short-termism is often determined by sort of the cycles that occur within a business, aren't they? Because again, going on back to my recruitment career, basically my entire year was basically a sequence of 12 months, right? Because it was a monthly target. So my only concerns were what was happening next 4 weeks and, you know, whatever happened, you know, next month. So what are the cycles that occur within business? It's got to be budgeting year, isn't it? Like you say, it goes down on mainly a yearly sequence. So maybe this is something that pops into a hiring manager's mind once a year, and that's the frequency, right? So it's quite a low frequency, high importance, low frequency event. So how do we change that? Do we somehow like do budgeting more regularly, or do we forget about budgeting? Like, why do we do budgets? We have the data already about how much we were making. Like, why is there an annual thing at all? Thoughts on this?
Go on, CJ.
Sorry. So I think it comes back to, you know, the budgeting cycle is where you end up with numbers leading the business as opposed to strategy leading a business. And that's all this is. You know, if you start with strategy and then did your budgeting kind of as a kind of embedded function within the strategy process, that is really beneficial. If you use budgeting and the output of budgeting to determine what you need to do with talent and people in your workforce, you're just reacting to kind of plugging a few spreadsheets with numbers. Now, I know budgeting is a lot more complex than that, but arguably that's what we're ending up with, is talent and getting talent and bums on seats being an output of a, I've presented an organization chart in my budgeting process. I told you I need those two extra heads and now I go and recruit them. And that's the cycle we're in at the moment.
It would seem, though, how do we solve the problem here, guys? I mean, because it seems to me that there's it's almost like, who solves it even? Like, you, do you know what I mean? It's like, TA doesn't seem as if it has enough weight to be able to push people to do stuff. So maybe this is actually part of the stress that we have, because we're probably having that conversation, you know, hey, can you tell us in advance what you're looking for? I think we know that's a good idea, but we don't have the weight to push that through and force a change. Hiring managers, it's a once a year thing for them, right? So they'd probably just go through it and chuck it over the fence. Who does this then? Is there, what's the, like, how do we move to a position where workforce planning becomes embedded in the culture of the business?
Well, I think from our customers home, we see as part of that problem, you've described that as a once a year type activity. Well, that in itself is part of the problem, because organizations, they move and they change, right? And priorities change, they win new projects. So the sweet spot for our workforce planning that our customers see is every quarter. So it's not a 2-week massive exercise once a year that they do, because as soon as they complete that exercise and the business starts to change, all of that data starts to go out of date very quickly. So what our customers start to see is, actually, why don't we do a smaller, like, workforce planning exercise 4 times a year, which is more fluid and more agile and fits the business plans better than a once a year activity. Because again, the other part of that is a once a year activity, again, line managers, they're not trained, they're not equipped to do a big once a year budgeting strategy plan. What does my future? They're not going to do it. But if you break that huge exercise down into very, very simple 4 times a year exercise, you're more likely to get more managers to do it and more ownership.
I want to come back. Yeah, I was going to say, I want to come back to what Adam said earlier on, because he had two key words that matter: talent intelligence. So a business does nothing without customer intelligence or market intelligence, does it? Because it needs to know where to play and who to sell to and what the likely trajectory of that is. Yet we seem very content to just stumble through without talent intelligence. So I think that's where it perhaps comes from. And it is genuinely that people are so uneducated about the value of capabilities that we need and people who can deliver that. So it does come back to that. I'll give you an example, actually, Hung, that supports this. I did some work in a defence technology industry, and they had a role where they reckon there are only 300 people in the world who can do this. So they know they're going to have to recruit through the nose to get these people in. They had absolutely no future trajectory to buy somebody in who could then create an internal academy to support that with a bench. They had they just said, no, let's get them in, and as long as we can keep them, we'll just do that. And so they were just in this cycle of playing through the nose for these specialists, not creating capabilities. That's where it really falls down.
So a couple of things that are emerging for me. So thank you so much for the education here, folks. Essentially, we need to break away from an annual cycle. So if we're doing anything with an annual in it, you know, if an annual review, annual whatever, that's a red flag in your business, because guess what? You're going to do this review, it's going to be out of date. And not only that, but the managers are not habituated to think about planning. They've already done the planning. Go ahead and fix it, TA. And that's basically something we have to argue against. So I think maybe the learnings we get from software world will help us a little bit, in the sense it's a lot more sprint-based. They're usually 2 weeks, maybe 2 weeks is too much, but, you know, once every quarter seems doable. And we need to start, like, having a conversation to say, guys, we're going to do a workforce. Do we call it workforce planning, or do we call it something once every quarter, just to sort of temp check where we're at, and then just refresh all of the information to make sure this is still a focus, this is still a target, and we're realigning where we're at. I think that seems to be one of the techniques we could use. Perry, I want to lean a little bit more on your idea of talent intelligence. How do we get more intelligent about our talent then? What do we do?
Yeah, before I come in on that, the Corporate Research Forum did some research last year about strategic workforce planning. 40-something percent of people said that they do some form of it, right? But 73% of them said they have no idea about the value it creates. They have absolutely zero metrics to justify why they even do it. So there's a big problem about numbers and counting. So how do we get talent intelligence? I think we do have to regularize and normalize when we have conversations about things like how are we as a function now and how do we need to be in that sort of near future and next future, and kind of map out the skills. Now you kind of go, but what about the skills you don't know yet? Well, you can start to see what's emerging. So at some point, Facebook knew they were going to get into avatar-based metaverse production, right? So people were saying, well, nobody has that skill yet. Well, no, but you do know about some of the technologies that are starting. So they must have acquired people to even build it, because that wasn't a prescribed list on a crappy job description somewhere. They had to speculate towards that. So there is something about how do we map that stuff? How do we find out what the market's doing? So we bring market intelligence out to look at what other people are doing in adjacent industries and so on. And we need to crunch all that data and start looking then and say, what have we got? Where is it? And is it lined up right, in the right place, led in the right way, with the right strategic direction? So I've been working with clients to do exactly that. They're having to do it quite conversationally. They haven't got the benefit of Danny's software, but they probably will do now they've seen this, to start to put that together and start mapping it out. Because I think that's what it needs to be. It's literally like chess pieces on a board.
So this is a big chew of work in it. You need to have basically a skills tax, like a skills, yeah. How do you call it? A breakdown of the skills and capability, yeah, within your business, essentially.
Mm. Yeah.
You also need a breakdown of all the things that, you know, the tactical stuff that needs to be delivered. So it's one thing knowing what skills you've got. It's another thing knowing what kind of you tactically need to deliver. And then, like, what are going to be the new tactics? So, you know, it's about kind of, if we fast forward a year from here and we've managed to deliver the plan, which of the talent, which of the talent kind of faux pas or things we got wrong, what's going to derail our strategy? And we don't do enough of that. Let's fast forward to a point in time where this, you know, epic strategy is going to deliver. You know, it's like an organization saying, we're going to go after a new vertical this year. Fantastic. Everyone gets excited about, we're going after a new vertical. Fast forward 12 months, they have no skill in that vertical whatsoever in the organization, and the whole strategy falls on its ass. So then people get embedded with, do you know what, every time we try and do a bit of a curveball, change direction, have a new bold strategy, it goes wrong. But it was about talent. We just don't do enough fast forward and then rewind to see where would our gaps be if this really failed.
That's really interesting. It seems to me that, is this beyond TA? Is this something that TA sort of needs to build as an internal skill set to be able to do workforce planning? Or do we kind of just say, look, it's an expert thing, roll in an expert to come in and just do this for us and give us a framework or give us a tool, and then that's where we get started to work on it. I can imagine a lot of people listening to this thing, and that's all great, but I have got operational pressures right now. How am I going to possibly take on this huge project? What's your prognosis on this? What's your advice on this? I mean, do you come down one way or the other in terms of, you know, how it actually gets done?
Sorry, I'm in danger of getting overexcited. Don't think about it as a project for a start. You know, it's kind of this. You can't do talent as a project and then move on to the next thing. That's like running a business as a project. This is part of the fabric of an organization. We treat it as a project. It's going to be like any other project where we finish it and we move on to the next thing. It's got to be embedded. And it's about strategic internal partnerships. So it's not about one person driving the bus. It's about kind of everyone kind of moving in the same direction on this together and knowing how important it is. So I will stop ranting because I never shut up if I keep going.
No, these rants are excellent. You keep going, CJ. Aren't they good? We need to hear more of this. The vision I'm getting is that there needs to be a leader in TA that's able to have a conversation with the senior leadership of the business and just get them to agree, look, this is the thing that we have to put more time, that needs to be a priority for us. We can't just say once every year we're going to do this. This is, they have to be be able to make the case that this is important. So how do they make the case? How do we equip HR leaders, TA leaders with the tools, the know-how, the argument to be able to make that case at that level? Thoughts on this? Open it up.
Well, so to continue what CJ was saying, can you imagine another professional function in an organization not working towards a plan? If you said to the CFO, go and do your job, get your function to run without a plan. The supply chain function, go and do your job without a plan. How many materials do you need versus product? You'd be laughed out of the room, right? So why is HR operating in that same fashion? Is it because it's a relatively new concept in terms of we're not operating without a workforce plan? I mean, it beggars belief that other functions would never dream of doing their job without a plan. And maybe everybody goes on about the seat at the table, yada, yada, yada. Maybe that's why we don't get that seat at the table, because we're not credible enough yet to say and push back and say, hang on a minute, we can't deliver these business objectives from a people perspective because there's no plan. I mean, it's as simple as that, isn't it?
Just to back that up, Danny, I've had clients who've come to me where the business thinks they have a strategic workforce plan, but they don't. They just have a slightly glorified org chart with a little bit of succession. That's all they have. So I think there's a challenge here for us to show people what the hemorrhage is of not having a strategic workforce plan, what we're losing out on. Some people can't even tell you, if they lose a key figure, what the actual on cost of that is, i.e. the recruitment cost and the capability cost to get them back up to that level. So I think we've been kidding ourselves. We've got some form of workforce plan when we absolutely haven't. So I think we need to sort of, you know, do the open kimono thing, right? We need to just make that bare and naked and say, business, this is so important to you, because then I think we can do the connecting with others piece. Because I think if a TA lead is on this, they will absolutely need business partners who are out working in the domains and the business to kind of go, stop faffing around with ER cases, give that to the ER function and start asking these questions about skills, capabilities, future, all that kind of stuff, and give me that intelligence. So I think we need a collective HR effort. TA could spearhead it, absolutely, because they need to stop the roundabout on this constant attrition thing, which is demoralizing and killing businesses and choking innovation.
CJ, the audience demands that you say something.
Yeah.
So I got lost in chat. So I was just, the thing for me is that we kind of get lost in this, imagining that this is kind of something really complex. And actually, we've done ourselves a disservice by calling it strategic workforce planning, because most people are thinking WTF. And unless you're in it, you're thinking, I don't know what that is. And people who are busy running businesses just need to understand, what's the simple thing I can do tomorrow to make this a little bit easier for my organization? And the simple thing you do tomorrow is recognize that the reason people get hung up on yearly budget cycles is because that's what gets proactively discussed and managed in organizations. So anytime someone comes into a review, you're talking about, where's your strategy, and have you kind of looked backwards and decided what talent you would need to fulfill that strategy? It's about having kind of regular conversation about it. We all know that's what brings things to life. And I would love to say something far more intelligent and more Jedi-like, but it's as simple as that, bluntly.
No, I totally get it. There's a need to simplify it, and we have to resist jargonization, so to speak, and create it into something that is intimidating for the managers to have to learn. And like they need to understand, we need to be accessible to them, and give them something that they can work with. What does a workforce plan look like? Is it just a massive spreadsheet?
Bloody hope
I hope not, actually. No, exactly. That. No. I think there's something about how we present it that's actually, again, something that might need to be seriously looked at, because I can't imagine anybody getting excited about something like that. Just saying, look, here's a spreadsheet with a load of capabilities that have got some percentage ranking. People look at it and go, and? So this is where I think it needs to be visual. It needs to be a map. It needs to have much more powerfully alluring things for people to go, ah, that's what you mean by mapping capabilities to the value chain and the consequence of what that can deliver for us if we've got that lined up. So HR strategies and people strategies generally are a bit too dull in my liking. They need to excite the shit out of people. And I think a strategic workforce plan ought to do the same, because then I think the board are going to be a bit more interested in it, because I think it captures the essence of human endeavour, that they don't have any other format that does that.
Do the business trust the report that they get from us, though? I mean, if you're giving numbers like, hey, we've got like 80% capability on this, wouldn't a CEO think, like, did you get that number? Like, did you just make that up? Like, how do we evidentialize this? How do we generate it in such a way that it is actually, you know, we can stand on it and say, look, we think this is accurate and here's the evidence for it.
Having been a chief people officer and then a CEO, I can categorically tell you a lot of people related numbers are made up and it's not helpful. And I think if we got better with data, it would be much more helpful to our organizations. But you can't expect HR to just pull data from nowhere. It's got to come from the organization. So that's where these internal partnerships are so useful, because otherwise you're not having the conversations about, is this data accurate that's feeding into our strategy? You just get lost.
Can we just imagine a scenario then? So I'm speaking to a line manager. I need some information or data from that manager is going to know the skills or capability of the department, I would hope. How is that person going to give me the information in such a format that I can go and use it in some way to say, look, this is our assessment of where we're at and where we need to be? Do we need to create some sort of like questionnaire or something? Like, how do we get this information?
I think Danny should plug his software here.
I'm biting my tongue. But so Hung, you described it exactly there. So when you're having that conversation, so one, why can't we get that information? The first one reason is there are thousands of line managers, very few of us in HR. So use technology to have those conversations en masse, because our time is better spent looking at the data rather than collecting it. The second point, how do you walk that person through? You could use a survey type interface, right? I'm not going to plug my software, to walk them through very, very simple questions, right? Don't call it a workforce planning exercise, right? Don't call it that. It'll turn them off. Like Perry said, you need to excite the shit out of them. Tell them what's in it for them. Make it real in terms of, tell us this information, Mr. or Mrs. Line Manager, and we will be able to make your team fuller for longer, which means more productivity, which means more revenue, which means more bonus, right? They're going to think, shit, I'm going to do this. There's something in it for me there. And then walk them through a very simple exercise, but only en masse. When all of that data aggregates through, the people in HR can then go, right, there we go. There's our hiring plan. There's our succession gaps. There's our capability risk. There's our flight risks. It's no more complicated than that, than having thousands of conversations, but use a machine to do it for you.
Yep.
So you just can't to add to that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, just to add to that, because I didn't have Danny's software in my mind when I had a client work recently, I just created a canvas with question prompts and capture mechanisms, but linked inextricably to the value that they are trying to create through the people they've got. And if they can't point to the value that those people are trying to create, they've got some serious questions about what that role is. Is it a bullshit job then? Or is it actually adding value to what you do? So it actually helps them with a little bit of org design thinking as well when you do this right.
So this is all great, by the way, but I want to dive a little bit more granular, even if it does mean taking a little bit more of a look at an interface. So what you're asking questions about skills. How open or closed is that question, guys? I mean, is it a case of what skills you need in your role? Or do you say, how do you ask the question in such a way, I guess, that it can be collected and then use that scale, as Danny says? I mean, what is the phrasing we need to use? What's the interface?
And I've got a supplementary question to that one, which is, I'd really love CJ to explain about the, you know, job descriptions should be dead. And in which case, how do we deal with the legal aspects of firing people for not meeting, you know, what they're meant to be doing, for example?
All right. That's a great question. We'll definitely lean on it, CJ. But let's deal with the first one. What is the question? What questions enable us to collect the information from the hiring manager? Danny, just give us some examples of questions that would work here.
Well, this would then come down to the capability of the person you're asking, right? And in 99% of organizations, the line manager doesn't have the capability to break down the skills of what makes a job, right? So the first thing is, just ask them what the job is. Don't let them do the breakdown of the skills if they haven't got the capability to do it. Say, what roles will you need in your function? And if that's as simple as, I need IT tech support and service desk engineers, right, okay, fantastic, thanks for telling us that information. Behind the scenes, we'll break that job down into the skills on your behalf, Mr. or Mrs. Manager. Because again, these people out there in the field, they're experts at their job. Let's not try and over-engineer it. Let's just get what information we can. And then behind the scenes, we'll break down those job descriptions into what those skills are needed to do that. So that's what I would say is, first of all, think about the capability of your line managers. 99% of the time, they won't have the ability to do that. So keep it simple.
That's actually really important. Like, the line manager might know, quote unquote, implicitly, but they don't know explicitly, because this is not an exercise they've been trained to do. And this is actually not what they should be doing. They should be managing the function, not just doing all this analytical stuff. So you just take it off them. And then I guess the skill, I guess, for TA or is to be able to identify a tool or a framework or a support business, that's a service business that's going to help you break down a job description into the raw skills that can support this. And there's been some interesting work doing this, isn't there? There's companies and organizations doing skills taxonomy stuff. I think Nestor is an organization in the UK, isn't it, that are trying to say, right, we're going to break down every job that we know into a bunch of skills and then map them around. LinkedIn, don't they? Surely LinkedIn has something. Is there a usable tool that we can just dive into and experiment with here, or do we need to go spend millions to get some software?
I don't think we need to, other than Danny's software, obviously, but I don't think we need to necessarily purchase something off the shelf and go, that's how we do it. I think it starts to build up from, and actually people in their roles, right, they've got a lot to offer here because they're doing it all the time. So they can map out what skills and capabilities they think they've got when given the right circumstance. So you can literally build it from all the way through. It's how you capture it and how you can then interpret, leverage, and put a value and a weighting to that. I'm still really sick of that. The hate evaluation criteria being some Kentucky Fried Chicken recipe secret that they put a market value on something. It's like, how are you working that out? I'm not going to tell you. But how do I know it's valid then? I've had so many sticky instances around that. It's like, let's have something open source where we can give people the chance to understand their value based on things like skills and competencies and so on and so forth. So we're having discussions, aren't we, at the moment about should we advertise pay rates in job ads? Yes, I think we should. But there's also something in there which is like, how do people really know what they're worth unless they do that sort of thing? There is no tool to help them calculate. So because there isn't, we kind of have to get into conversations within organizations that they understand the value that capabilities have right through the line. And we in HR and TA can aggregate that. We can use that data. When people say, I've got this new role coming up, we can use that to pull from, but we can also go, what's the new skills that we haven't got anything on? And how do we get some kind of value onto those? So we have got to almost like re-database this stuff, I think.
So it's kind of like, tell me a bit more about the weighting side of it, Perry. What do you mean by weighting?
So you can have somebody who works in a law firm who's incredibly specialist in a piece of maritime law or something. So they've had to study and get all sorts of capabilities right, because when you next get a maritime client in, you know they're going to go in there and they've got lots and lots of money. And so, they might be subject to being poached because of the nature of that complexity of the law that they know intimately, right? So there's a weighting to that. They don't just know the law. They know the law in a very specific context. So therefore, they're the sort of person you can think there's more weight to that role because of its uniqueness and what they've had to craft to get there than somebody who's just come in and knows a little bit about tort. Do you see what I mean? There's something about the weighting in the demand and the complexity and the impact it has on the value you can create. That's what I mean by that.
Can you create that yourself, or is there as Michael says, some sort of like open source thing like floating out on the internet we could just grab and use? Or is this like going to take like a huge amount of work for us to figure out waiting for the roles that we have?
I'm sure there are mechanisms we can put to it, because we can start to compare a type of role with another one that's in an adjacent industry and start thinking, hang on a minute, that engineer gets paid that, therefore that lawyer must be very similar, even if it doesn't exist in the true sense of the word. So talent intelligence can exist in that sort of wider market space too as well. We can collaborate to sort of find some of that out. But we're not yet in a state where everything's commoditized to that point, right? So there is no real index where we can go to.
I think we're close, aren't we? I mean, it seems to me that this is emerging, and it's also one of these things that will kind of be eased by the datification of the organization, so to speak, because the shift to remote obviously digitizes a lot of work. We're going to get a much deeper understanding as to what people do simply because we have to do it, a great deal of it via digital means. And by the way, that also includes stuff where people are doing physical work. You know, people are getting tracked in terms of their location, they're wearing stuff, wearables, all this type of stuff will help us understand what is actually involved in the job much more than it was in the analog era. And from there, we might be able to start being super intelligent about how, you know, how to use some of this data that's being generated ambiently by the workforce, because the difference between this ambient data is basically it's revealed behavior rather than reported behavior, which may actually be two different things. And in fact, they're almost inherently two different things. So I guess there's a technological journey we need to go on in order to get there, but we don't have time to wait for the future, folks. So if there's HRDs and TA leaders listening right now and they're wondering, oh my goodness, how do I get my TA? How do I get my business into more of a workforce planning mindset? How do we do that? Can we go round the room here a little bit and just give one piece of advice, practical advice that they can use to help nudge the marble forward a little bit for them? Perry, let's go to you first.
Okay, I think it comes back to mapping your capabilities to your value chain. Get somebody to do that exercise at that high level, and then everything should trickle down from that because other people can map skill sets to that. So value chain, capabilities, start there.
What do you mean value chain, Perry? Just expand
that. So the flow of value through your company, from how you prospect to how you get leads in to how you manufacture or deliver your service, just the whole value chain end to end, everything you do that creates value somewhere along the line.
Yep. Okay, great. CJ, do you want to say something practical advice to a TA or HR leader?
Yeah, so I would be saying you need to sit down with the business strategy in front of you, and you need to intimately know what your organization is trying to achieve in terms of targets and kind of growth in the next period. And then you need to have conversations in your workforces about the skills you've got. And I'm not just talking about the skills in the roles, just skills generally. I might be a doctor and I'm working as a cleaner. So what are the skills you've got and what are the skills you need? And keep it as simple as possible for those early conversations, because that's how you get traction. It's the micro goals around talent strategy that will make the biggest difference.
Yeah, very good. And Danny, go to you finally. Like, what is a practical thing they can do in order to move this conversation forward internally?
For TA and HR, maybe start talking more business language. So a quick tip would be, work out the cost of re-recruiting, retraining, and re-onboarding one individual in your organization. Just work out the cost for one, then multiply that by how many hires you make a year, and take that number, because it will be in the millions and millions of pounds, to the CEO, and nothing will get it on the radar quicker than that.
Yeah, so I'll sell the pain. I love it, man. Sell the pain. Go ahead, Adam.
I've got one too, as the non-expert on this subject, and mine is, before you take that number to the CEO, make sure that you get your bonus aligned with whatever that number is going to be.
That's actually really smart thinking. You know,
100% get that, because often, like HR and TA leaders, they put these huge figures on their CVs, don't they? So I'll save this amount of money from agency reduction. Nothing will trump that figure that Adam just said, in terms of you take 10% of that. Right, and get your bonus linked to that, you'll be a millionaire.
A quick one, I want to go dive into this idea of linking it to the hiring manager, but I've totally forgot to do one thing, which I'm going to do now. For every time we do this show, we want to do is make sure that Brain Food Live is not the blocker for a continuation of this conversation. So if you're interested in workforce planning, this is a topic that you're keen on. I see that more or less everyone who signed up to this is still watching it. So now is the time to make sure you're connected with everyone else who's participating in this conversation. So take a moment, get your LinkedIn profile and share it in the chat stream like Michael has done there, and just connect with everyone else who's sharing that LinkedIn. Do that on LinkedIn itself, by the way. Share it in the comments. Do it on Facebook also. We're going to try and just basically make sure we're more heavily networked and networked around the topic that you're interested in. So no, this is not about employer branding. This is not about sourcing. This is about strategic workforce planning. If this is something you care about, make sure you're connected with other people that also care about this. And then please continue the conversation with those people, because there's no reason why Brain Food Live should start the conversation and then have to finish it because, you know, we run out of time. So go ahead and spend a minute or two doing that. I want to leave it with a final point. How do we align it to line managers' incentives? How do we make sure, or how do we kind of create incentives for the line manager to really want to help us with this? And appeals to their better nature, I think, is, you know, something obviously we should do, but that's generally ineffective. So what can we do to incentivize them to do better?
I don't think they don't need any incentive, do they? I mean, they're them and their team are going to perform higher if they nail this subject.
Well, what more incentive is there from that? Well,
but I don't think they've made that connection, Adam.
Right, there you go.
What you've just said there, Adam, is a 100% common sense, but managers, they've not made that connection.
Make it easy. I've just been reading a really interesting book on influence. And actually, because of the way our brains function, we go to the path of least resistance all the time. We don't spend enough time in organizations making everything as easy as possible to do great stuff and great work and have great customers. And that's where we need to spend time and attention. Make it easy.
Yeah. Final thoughts to you, Perry. How do we incentivize line managers to really align with this idea? Theoretically, I think everyone's, yeah, let's do more planning, but it never happens.
Yeah,
so
totally.
Obviously the incentives aren't aligned. So how do we do that?
Well, the idea is you're a team leader, aren't you? But what we've done is we've stacked managers' jobs with too many projects and tasks so they don't lead the team. So I think there's something where we need to create a little separation, I think, from that and say, right, there's your task, but you've got to look after your people, and this is a crucial part of it. So I think actually there's something we can do systematically now to make sure that's the case, because they're too stacked. The people stuff gets forgotten about. So let's ramp that back up by saying that's what you're going to be measured on.
That's really interesting, and that leads to kind of the world where we're at now. Basically, if we shift to remote, surely that means more software is going to help the managers do the management, so to speak, and in fact, they can then do the people stuff more. So theoretically, this is what we need to do. We need to actually resist giving managers more work, because this is a piece that they've neglected, and we need to do it that way. Okay, that's about it, folks. Thank you so much, everyone, for watching. Thank you, Perry, Timms, for joining us. Great to have you on the show. CJ, you've been an absolute star. Thank you so much for your a hugely insightful commentary. Danny Hodgson, please get better lighting next time. But always great value to get your contributions as well. Sort of telling it as it is, as usual. Thank you so much for your contribution, everybody. That was great, wasn't it? I think that's about it. Thanks for watching, everybody. Appreciate everything you're doing. We are back next week. It is actually on Thursday. We're going to talk about salary transparency. So if you're moving to salary transparency, make sure you register that to the next show. We're going to do it on Thursday because basically on Friday, I've got to do an event. I'm going to be in Berlin, by the way. So if you're in Berlin, let me know. So Thursday is where I'm going to do the show from the Mickelberger Hotel in Berlin, which is a crazy hotel there. I'm looking forward to doing it from there. Salary transparency. On Tuesday, we're also going to be speaking with Will Laufer, CEO of Prelude. So if you fancy the Founders Focus again, make sure you check that out. Follow the channel if you want to watch all of those things. Okay, that's about it. Thank you very much. Good show where neither of us knew what we're talking about, Adam. And I appreciate you sitting there listening more than talking, which is unusual for you. But still, did you learn something? I mean, I did. I definitely learned something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important when you've got people that know things that more about a subject than you, you listen and you ask questions. So that's why I didn't say an awful lot in that session. And mostly my contribution was like pretty crappy dad jokes, basically.
That's fine.
you know.
You're here for comedy value anyway. That's the primary contribution.
No, thank you. I did post something at the very end of the show there in the chat, which I do think is important. I think that there are a few of these subjects are actually probably bigger than talent acquisition.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, workforce planning is about running the business. It's about organizing your business. And I think it's, I don't agree with Danny that it is the only fix that and you fix everything, but I do think it's really important. The other two things that I think are equally important are employer brand. And I don't mean how you position your organization on your career site and how you write your job ads. I mean, who's your leadership? What does your company do? What's it? What's its purpose for the world? You know, all that sort of stuff. Again, it's bigger than talent acquisition. And then the third one is your talent pipeline. Who wants to work for you? How many people are interested in working for you? All three of those things are really vital. And the third one probably arguably is TA, but the first two are bigger than TA. So
Maybe TA needs to get bigger. I mean, it could be that the function itself needs to expand to take on greater responsibilities if currently there isn't, that's not being done, you know? So it's one of those where maybe this is an opportunity for TA to expand scope, which is what I've been banging on about for ages anyway, but I think we need to do that.
Definitely agreed. The only thing is, I would say, and I have said it on this show, I would say that the thing that should lead all of this is employer brand. And again, I don't mean employer brand in terms of how are we going to describe our company and, you know, what's our EVP? I mean, how are we going to make sure that our organization is successful through people? And I think everything in HR should, I've said this before, it's quite controversial. Everything in HR should report into employer brand, in my opinion. That should be the absolute top of the apex for HR.
I'm pleased to see your commitment to the idea, Adam. You keep pounding that drum, mate. Anyway,
another 3 years' time, I'll still be saying the same thing, and I'll still be getting criticized for it.
Oh, by the way, aren't you in Seville next week? You are, aren't you?
We'll be on the show next week. I'll be in Seville. I have during this, about 5 minutes before this show, I got on my. Let me hang on a second. Let's do this together. I don't know if you can see that, but let's go my UEFA account. I haven't looked at this yet. Tickets. Come on.
Cancelled, rescinded.
Hang on. Yes, look. I've got my ticket.
That's great. Yes.
After the amount of money I've spent on getting there and like staying there.
That's the high risk, isn't it? Because no one's going to comp you back. You just have to throw the money at it. And then, you know, if you're going to go, just go to a bar someplace. If you didn't have the chance of the ticket. How many is the Mestalla Stadium? 60,000, isn't it? The Mestalla?
No. It's 40,000. Why would you 40,000. Have such a big game in such a mid-sized football stadium? There must have been at least 80,000-seater stadiums in Europe they could have done this in. Why a 40,000-seater stadium? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Because it's a B-rate competition, Adam. You know what I mean? It didn't expect that many clubs to be interested.
The demand for tickets for this game has been bigger than the Champions League final.
Is that right? I can actually believe it.
According to a friend of mine who I'm going to this game with, who works for Arsenal, he's got tickets from Just Eat. He's got tickets from EA. He's got tickets from all sorts. To make sure that me and my pals are getting to go. And he said that he's heard from UEFA that there's been more demand for tickets for this than the Champions League final.
Well, a lot of it is dependent, obviously, on the commitment to the fans. And was it you and Eintracht Frankfurt or something, isn't it? So it's it should be interesting. All right, listen, that's it. Good luck with that. Enjoy the trip. Have a good one, mate. Take it easy.
You too. Bye.